Okay, so now we're going to discuss experimental part of this standard model. So tomorrow I'll discuss the Higgs physics and QCD, and today I will concentrate on electroweak tests. So I will start with a short introduction on the implications of the choice of our gauge group for the standard model. So this I'm sure you have seen here and probably before, but it's just to put things into context, because the structure of the weak current seems to demand that it be SU2, and then you see that you need a new boson, the Z boson. It just appears out of the equations. And then people went to look for it in the early 70s and found it. So that will be a few slides. Now, I normally spend many hours on this part, in fact, for electroweak physics in my phenomenology course. So here, of course, I'll just flash a few results, and I can't go into detail, but at least it gives you an idea of how well measure the experiments confirm the standard model. Many of the plots I extracted from the LEP electroweak working group, which did the averaging of all the measurements from the four experiments at LEP, but also from SLC, the Stanford Linear Collider results, and from Atlas and CMS. Okay, so handwritten slides for a few slides. So if you remember in the weak current, what it's doing is it's changing one quark into another, or a charged lepton into a neutrino. So it's doing this transformation of one lepton into another. Now, if we try to do such a transformation, we see that SU2 seems to be our chosen group to do this, at least for the charge current. So we start with two fermion fields, and demand that it possess some symmetry under transformations that mix them together. And so we will have four coefficients here, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. And these are complex. Now we want to keep the normalization of our fields. We want to keep orthogonality. Okay, so an electron is not a muon. And so these will have consequences on the values that alpha, beta, gamma, delta can take. So in 2D component form, it will look like this. So we have this matrix. Now, this matrix is unitary, and a 2x2 unitary matrix has four free parameters that we can write this way. Now, there are many ways of writing this out, but one way is to use the Pauli matrices here. Okay, and these you've seen before, I'm sure. And so we have essentially one phase, and then this V, and V is a member of SU2. Okay, so now we're gonna try to select a gauge group for the EM and weak interactions. So we have the weak current for a given lepton, and it's written like this. So we have the 1 minus gamma 5 that will select left-handed helicities. Just to come back to what I was saying, we focus on a charge current initially because this is what people were observing, beta decay at the beginning of the 60s. There was no neutral weak current, right? And so we had electromagnetic interactions were established, and we had the weak current. Okay, so it looks like this. So we can introduce then a left-handed isospin doublet that looks like this, with D3 plus or minus one half, depending where you are. So if you're here, it's plus one half. If you're here, it's minus one half. So right now we keep the neutrinos massless, and we can accommodate the right-handed part for the charged lepton in a weak isospin singlet. So here T equals zero. And so the charge weak current can be written like this. So this, these are the Pauli matrices. And we can expand this explicitly through the matrix 1, matrix 2, and matrix 3. And the currents will look like this. So you have left, 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 left. So you're changing lepton and neutrino into a lepton. and you have also this another term here for J2. You have this J3 here. And so this looks like a neutral current, right? You're not changing the charge of the leptons. And but it's not electromagnetic because the neutrino has no electric charge. So this is an extra term that we'll need to deal with. But with J1 and J2 here, we're happy because as far as the charge current is concerned, we can write it in this way. So the positive current, the negative, as a combination of J1 and J2. As I just said, J3 involves a neutral current. And here we're trying to throw in our well-known EM interaction. So the EM interaction doesn't have a 1 minus gamma 5. It doesn't care about left-handed or right-handed terms. It has both, right? It couples left and left and right and right. And so we can sort of define, knowing this and the previous term, we can introduce another current, which is a hypercharge, which will have these terms. So what we're trying to do is introduce something that will bring about EM here, electromagnetic. So with this combination, whoop, did I skip it? Right. So GEM then, if once we write the hypercharge in this way, will be J3 plus 1/2 of the hypercharge current. Okay, so one thing that we can try then for our gauge group for the standard model is since we have a charge current that deals with left-handed particle, we introduce SU2L. There's an extra term here that involves also left-handed particles, and we add something else, and then we will have our EM interaction. So the gauge bosons associated with SU2L will be these W123s, and the one with associated with the U is the of hypercharge will be BU. So if we take a look at the fermion gauge coupling, take a look at the gauge covariant derivative, it will look like this. So we have one term here for the SU2 part and another here for the hypercharge. So for the right-handed part, this drops out. So it just involves the B mu. And then we can, the couplings then for G are, will be G for SU2 and G prime for U1, this U1, with the following values for the hypercharge for left and right. Okay, so then we can write it, our Lagrangian like this. So we have a term that involves left-handed particles and another with right-handed particles. So the first term, if we expand, we get these two parts. And the first part is our charge weak current, okay, that where you mix W1, W2. Okay, so we can define the physical field as like this. But we can concentrate now on the neutral current terms, which involve both L and right components. And so we have a W3, and here we have a B mu and the terms in front of them. Okay. And so this is the J3 current, and this is the hypercharge current. Okay, so if you remember, the EM current is a mixture of these two, and so we'd like to have we'd like to see a GEM appear from those equations so that we can associate a physical field that we know well, the photon, which should be a mixture of those two. And so, since it's a mixture, we can try rotation of these two fields, where cosine theta W and sine theta W are defined here. Okay, and so with the rotated fields, you rotate the fields, then we have an AMU and we have a Z mu. The AMU has exactly the correct form for the EM interaction. You have the J3 1 half J hypercharge. So this one we know exists, and this one is new, right? So we had the weak charge current, we have this that we know, and if we want our group to be SU2L cross U1 of hypercharge, then we have this extra term. Okay, so this first term is just the EM interaction. I'm gonna go to the next one. Or maybe I went a little too fast here. So this is the first term, EM interaction. The second term involves the Z boson. And so we can simplify, if you want, the expression. And so we see that it will involve these terms, 1 minus sine squared theta W minus sine squared theta W. And here we have J3 mu, and we have the value of the hypercharge current here. Okay, so if we summarize this interaction for the Zs, it's going to look like this. So we have one term that is our 1 minus, or the GV here, the vector part and an axial part. So GV is given by this term and GA by this term. And what makes this quite interesting is that it means that there's a complicated structure here. I mean, for ZNU, or there's a lot going on. So depending on what type of lepton you are, or whether you're an up-type fermion, or a down-type fermion, the results will be different. You expect the Z to couple in a different way. So for the neutrinos, it's pretty straightforward. So GA and GV are 1 half. For the charged lepton, the charge is minus 1, GA is minus 1 half. And this term, GV, will have this value once you plug in sine squared theta W. So you have different values here for GV. You notice that this value for GV is quite small for leptons, but rather large and negative for down-type quarks. Okay, so we have a lot to test here, right? We're supposed to find one Z boson, and we should be able to measure its partial width, the way it decays, for instance, or how it's produced. And the couplings are given by all this. It means that the coupling to the electron and muon and the tau should be the same. UCT should be the same, DSB should be the same, and all of these should be different. Okay, so there are many things then that we can do using the Z boson. We can look at the width. We can look at decay rates to up-type quarks, down-type quarks, charged leptons, neutrinos. So measure the invisible width. We won't see the neutrinos. And as I mentioned before, test coupling universality. So the electrons should couple to the Z like muons or taus, which is not the case, as we'll see tomorrow, for the Higgs. The Higgs couples to mass. So the masses are different for these fermions, so the coupling will be different. But here, the Z should be the same. We can look at production asymmetries, and I'll have a few slides on this, for various fermion types. So the angular distributions will be different whether you're an up-type quark or a down-type quark, or whether you're a lepton or a neutrino, although we don't see the neutrinos. Another thing that we can do is we can measure the mass precisely, which then allows for tests of the self-consistency of the standard model. And I'll have a slide or two on that probably tomorrow. Okay, so as I mentioned before, this something new here wasn't obvious that it would be there, but they found it using this detector. If you've been at CERN, you can see it. It's in one of the squares, and so this experiment is called Gargamel. And so what they were looking for were neutral currents. So they had a beam of muon neutrinos that they fired in this tank, and what you were looking for was a muon that would emerge, or not necessarily a muon, but a particle that would just get a kick from this muon. So and all the holes here were for cameras. So this is old school, where you fired the beam, you took a picture, or many pictures in 3D, and then you would manually look at the pictures and make measurements for momentum if you have a magnetic field. So it takes a lot of time to do this. And if you remember from the previous talk on the LHC, we're doing this, but with 40 megahertz. It would take a lot of time if you wanted to find the Higgs boson with a device like this. Now, the mass of the Z boson was measured very, very precisely by LEP. And the way that they measure it is not using the detectors, because you can measure the energies with calorimeters, and they could get a measurement out of that. But you get a better measurement from the machine itself. The machine knows the energy that it's putting into the beam, and you can scan the resonance at various energies and do a fit and figure out what's the mass of the Z boson. And it's extremely well known. It's a precision measurement. So it's, I think, two parts in 0.02%, right, I think. It's in terms of all the bosons that we've measured up until now, this is our best measurement, MZ. And they had to do quite a bit of gymnastics. So this is from the PDG. Okay, precise energy calibration was done outside normal data taking using the resonant depolarization technique. Runtime energies were determined every 10 minutes by measuring the relevant machine parameters and using a model which takes into account all the known effects, including leakage currents produced by trains in the Geneva area and the tidal effects due to gravitation forces of the sun and the moon. So, and what you see here is the mass of the Z boson as a function of time. and they saw that it was, and this is the model prediction from the tides. So you know that the Earth, well, you know about tides, ocean tides, but the crust of the Earth is also getting deformed a bit as the moon and the sun go around us. And so that means that this big ring that's 27 kilometers around will sort of lift and expand and contract a little bit, not much. But when you have a super precise machine, you can see these types of effects. Other things that they saw was seasonal fluctuations, because when the snow melts, I don't know if you've been to Geneva, the Alps are kind of far away, but there's another mountain chain right next to CERN. In fact, the ring goes under those mountains, the Jura Mountains. And so the snow melts, and then it goes, the water goes underground, and you've got Lake Geneva. And so it kind of squeezes the earth between the two. And so it squeezes the ring also. The train wasn't easy to find. So they had an effect. They knew it was periodic. And there was a bottle of champagne to the person who would find what it is. And it was the TGV leaving from Geneva, which is kind of interesting.
I heard they figured it out because it was the mass of W was different on a weekend than it was during the week. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, that's right. It was periodic, but you know, then you didn't see it. So what you can find out, what is somebody turning something on at CERN or around or a restaurant over the. And the fascinating thing to me is that these are the residual currents from the train, right? So this machine is 100 meters underground. And so when we think of the ground, we think of the ground as the ground, but actually if you put a current in it, then the electrons go somewhere, you know, they go around. And now there's just this big shiny metal thing, and so the machine can tell. So this is the Z line shape, what it looks like. It was measured by different experiments. So the resonance itself was measured by SLD, which was a detector at the Stanford Linear Collider, and the four experiments at LEP. So you can see that this peak was scanned at different energies. And then LEP increased its energy eventually to produce pairs of W bosons. And you can see, so you can go off peak and again make measurements. And eventually, the mass of the W boson is 80 GeV, so around 160. Whoops, it turns on. And so you can see the fits and the predictions, and it's pretty impressive. Now, these are older accelerators. That didn't see much. So this is basically the EM interaction. And it's starting to turn over here for Tristan. But had this machine been a little bit more energetic, it would have seen the rise. But it didn't. So the first thing that they did, I remember because I was a student, an undergrad student in December of 1990. The machine started in September of 89. And the first big measurement that they made was they measured the number of neutrinos. There could have been 4, 5, 6, I don't know, number of other families. And you can tell by doing this scan of the line shape. So you're measuring the total width of the Z boson. And you can calculate in the standard model what will be the width, the decay to EE, mu, mu, tau, tau. These should all be the same. Then hadrons. And whatever's left is the invisible width. And so if you only have two neutrinos, then it should be narrower. And if you have more neutrinos, it should be wider because there are more possibilities for you to decay. The lifetime will be shorter. If you have 15 neutrinos, it would be very large. And so they did this within a few months. And I think they had a result in November or December. And it was 3. And so after more precise scans, this is what you get. So it looks awfully close to 3. Here are some measurements of the partial widths. So you can calculate all this in a standard model and compare to predictions. And so if you want to check for lepton universality, you measure the Z decaying to E mu, mu, tau, tau. And these two, as you can tell, these three are all compatible. Now, the Bs and the Cs should not be the same because this is an up-type quark and this is a down-type quark. There are also some in terms of branching ratio, there are phase space effects, but you expect this to be different, and they are. And the invisible width is given by this. You'll notice that it's about twice as much as those three, as the standard model predicts. You can also impose lepton universality, so you can, if you do, then you're averaging over all the leptons. Okay, so another thing that you can do is look for angular distributions. So the differential cross section you can get from the amplitude squared, and then you do the full calculation. But it will involve essentially two important terms. One that is square and cosine theta, and one that is linear and cosine theta. So linear and cosine theta will not be symmetric, but this one will be, cosine squared theta will be. And so we have these little coefficients here. So before, in the previous slides, I had GV and GA, so it's the same thing at CV and CA, and they're related to R and L through these relations here. Okay, so the differential cross-section then will be proportional to, like I said, this term, 1 plus cosine squared theta and cosine theta, and where the A is given by these terms here and B by these terms. So what you can do is try to measure how often, so in these linear, in these colliders, you have a direction, say, for the positron. The positron is coming from this direction, produces a Z, and then positron continues in the same direction. Then we call that forward by definition. And if the positron's going this way, and it's emitted by the Z in the opposite direction, then it's backward. And so what we can measure is the difference between the events that are forward compared to those that are backward. Okay, and because we have this difference here of this cosine theta term, this should not be zero. Okay, so when you put everything together, you have these all these terms that you need to deal with. But we know what they are, and if you remember, they will vary. This example is for electrons and muons, but the Z decays to a different fermion type, then the values of these will change. Okay, so AFB then can be written like this with this AF in terms of these coefficients. So this is the vector part and the axial part. Okay, and I'll talk about left-right in a second. We can extract the AE from this left-right measurement. But these are the measurements for these asymmetries for the electron, muon, and tau. And they, again, agree pretty well. Now, the measurement of sine squared theta W at LEP is extracted with the best sensitivity through these asymmetries. And this is the value that you get. I'll show you the fits in the standard model in a second. So the interesting thing about the Stanford Linear Collider is that it could polarize its E-beams. So not the positrons, but it would polarize the E-beams. And so you could, so you can define this cross section where you have left-handed electrons, and then or left-hand, you need to average over the polarization of the positron, but you can set the polarization of the electron, either left or right, and again measure the difference between these cross sections. Okay, we'll measure the asymmetry. And if you do the calculation, you'll see that it's proportional to these terms. And you see some results here. So for mu mu and tau tau, so this is the production as a function of cosine theta for a left polarized beam and a right polarized beam. And now it's different for E plus E minus. I'll let you think about that maybe as an exercise. Why they should, you know, if it's universal, you'd think they would be the same. But why does it look like that? I'll let you think about it. This is a nice plot where on one axis they compare the forward-backward asymmetry for the leptons to the ratio of the partial width of going to hadrons and over leptons. Okay, so the combination is given here, and you can see that, okay, so for EEs in red, mu mu in purple, and tau tau in blue, and they all overlap, so they're all consistent with each other in this ratio, but also in the asymmetry. So for left-right asymmetries, so this is from the SLD as a function of year, and in the end, they measured this this value. Okay, so you can put all of this together and put this in a fit, and you'll see that the values that are measured are consistent with what you would expect from the standard model pretty much everywhere. The next plot shows the tensions where there are some. Okay, RB, or this RL, is the ratio of partial widths of quarks to leptons, and RB is of quarks to Bs. And if you look at the at all the values here, you can see where there is some tension with the measurements. So in general, it looks quite good. So this is a number of standard deviations. There is one that sticks out a bit, that a little below 3 sigma, which is this AFB. But apart from that.
Has the LHC re-evaluated that or something? Or had a comment to say about that one?
No, well, eventually we've produced a lot of Zs, but they had many advantages at LEP, right? So they're producing, the incoming particles are electrons, and then the outgoing are electrons too, whereas we start with quarks, and so plus the complications of a hadron collider, they have a complete kinematic reconstruction of the event because they're colliding in the center of mass of the detector, whereas we're always dealing with boosted boosted particles. But we are doing some of this, but we will never measure the mass of the Z boson like this. We need to use our calorimeters. And in fact, our calorimeters are calibrated using this, because it's so well known.
Sorry, what is AFB?
Which one?
What is the AFB, the one that is?
This is the forward backward asymmetry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so now we can switch to LEP2 and the LHC, so the next plots are for the for LEP2. So after they ran, so LEP was LEP1 was mission was to measure all these properties of the Z boson, which they did very, very well to high precision, as you can tell. And then they increased the energy of the machine, LEP2, to try to find new physics, but also start producing pairs of Ws. And so you need at least, like I said, 160 GeV to do that. So they increased the energy, and then they went to look for the Higgs and increased the energy up until the machine was basically smoking, and then they stopped and removed it and installed the LHC. So so this is just to say that we kind of need a Z boson. If you calculate the cross section of this process, so these two amplitudes, and you square everything, you calculate the cross-section. This cross-section explodes, basically. And so it will violate unitarity. But with the Z, the cross-section is well-behaved. It's not completely well-behaved, but you still need to add a Higgs at some point. But it looks much better, as you'll see on the next plot. Okay, so you add this term. Okay, so if you only have the neutrino exchange, it would look like this. So it really explodes. If you take out the ZWW diagram that we need, it's still shooting up. Once you add everything, this is your prediction. from the standard model, and these are the cross-section measurements from LEP at various energies. See, it follows quite nicely. I won't discuss this too much. I'll discuss couplings perhaps tomorrow. But another thing that you can do, of course, is that you have these these vertices now that you can study in detail, where you have a triple gauge vertex. You have the gamma WW, you have the Z WW. Now you can test if this is correct, or if you maybe you have other terms in there. So you can construct, if you want, sort of most general Lorentz invariant Lagrangian that describes triple gauge couplings. If you do that, you'll get 7 WW gamma couplings and 7 WWZ couplings. If you assume EM gauge invariance and CNP conservation, you have 5 left. And then there were some additional measurements by LEP with additional assumptions. So you reduce them to these 3. So I just want to show them to show that these extra couplings are consistent with the SM. So you have, this is a prediction, it's 1, 1, and 0. And so within uncertainties, we're not seeing anything else. So this is done in the context of an effective Lagrangian where new physics could modify the kinematics and potentially the rates. But everything has been consistent.
Have they looked at all for imaginary gauge coupling effects? Like, is that a thing?
Imaginary gauge?
Like you said, that you assume CP conservation. So I assume that meant that you took the gauge coupling to be real. Is that a correct statement? I guess it's real.
I'll discuss this tomorrow with the Higgs.
Okay.
Yeah. So, because we're doing similar things. So. All right, so now I'm going to switch to the LHC. So I showed this before, but you'll notice that there's a lot of electroweak physics in there. Well, the first thing to notice is that we have some predictions here with some uncertainties, and you see how well everything is pretty much on, right? It's pretty impressive. So this is the measurement. This is the theory uncertainty and the experimental uncertainty, and everything matches quite well. So in the electroweak sector, we have W and Z production. We have WW, gamma-gamma. We have WT. The Higgs we'll discuss later, WZ, ZZ, W-gamma, and then a bunch of others. And we're starting to see these very rare processes where you have a pair of top quarks with a W or a Z. So W is being emitted off a top quark, TT gamma, and W gamma gamma. I have a slide on this one. Okay, so W production at the LHC, it looks like this. So these are various predictions. So the first order, leading order calculation would predict this, then we have next to leading order, and then next to next leading order. And our measurements have been performed up until now at 7 and 8. And maybe by the end of the year, or early 2016, you might see some new points at 13 here. See where they land. And you see that the cross-section is going up, right? So we will be producing more WW bosons. And again, things seem to agree relatively well with the predictions. This doesn't come out very well. Oh, maybe CMS. So let's forget about Atlas, unfortunately, and focus on CMS. So these are multi-boson production cross-section at the DLHC. So gamma-gamma, weak boson with a gamma, WWZZ, etc. And those are the predictions in yellow and the measurements. You see that things are quite consistent. know, you expect, when you make many measurements, of course, you expect at least one to be a little far away. One sigma is 68% coverage, so one out of three should not be touching. Now, we can also look at the triple boson production. And as we get more and more data, we'll be able to look at all kinds of interesting final states where you have many W's and Z's, and we can compare that to the standard model. If you remember, so our electroweak theory is a non-Abelian theory, so the gauge boson interact with each other, which is not the case of the photon. Photon does not interact with itself. Gluons also have color charge, so they interact with each other. So they have you have triple gauge vertices, and you have quartic vertices too, or quartic couplings. Okay, so we have a W gamma gamma coupling in the standard model, and we should be able to extract it. Of course, there are many ways of producing photons in a W. But the first step is just to see that you can see these types of events. So one W and two high energy photons. And so you see that this has been done for two channels, and this is the background prediction. This is what was observed in the data. So there is a significant excess. So eventually we can turn this into measurements of the quartic couplings. So just to end, I wanted to mention maybe one interesting deviation still in the standard model, because up until now it looks beautiful. And maybe this is a hint. So this has to do with the anomalous moment of the muon. So so this is from the PDG. So if you remember, if you've got something that has a magnetic moment, and you put it in a magnetic field, it's gonna rotate, and so you can define this quantity for the anomalous magnetic moment as g minus 2 over 2, where g mu is the gyromagnetic moment or factor, and so in the standard model you expect some contributions from QED. And from electroweak physics, but also some hadronic interactions. Okay, and these are not, so we're not doing this at the LHC. It's, the best measurement has been done at the Brookhaven National Lab. And what you see here is the measurement and various calculations. And they're off by a bit, as you can tell. So this experiment now has been moved to Fermilab, and they hope to reduce the uncertainty here. So it'll be interesting to see what could happen. The reason it's interesting, of course, is that whenever you see loops like this, you can stick other particles in there that could affect this ratio. So if there's some supersymmetric particle, then it could change things. I should mention that for the electron, or maybe you know about the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, but the measurement is very, very impressive. So this is done with Penning traps. It has nothing to do with high energy physics, but this is measured to a fraction of a part per trillion. And the prediction is also at that level. So this, I believe, is the best measured quantity in science, in all of the physics. And you can extract also the value of alpha EM out of this to a very, very high precision. And this agrees. this agrees well, but not the muons. Okay, so that's all I had. You have any questions?
Why do you probably compare this so good and the others?
The electron?
Yeah, moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I can point you to the paper of Garrett, and because I was looking at it again. But this is the type of physics that they do in the basement at U of T with various traps. And so the reason it's easier for the electrons is there are lots of electrons. They're easy to find, and they don't decay. And so they need to control all their magnetic fields very, very well. But once you've got an electron, you know, you can measure it. Muons, as you know, will decay pretty quickly. Has a lifetime of an order a millionth of a second. So you need to watch it precess before it decays. So the measurements are quite different the way that they're done.
Yeah, I mean, no, the comparison between electron and muon. Mm-hmm. I mean, the comparison between this anomalous magnetic moments and other instruments, where this anomalous magnetic moments can be very similar.
Yeah, one part per trillion?
Yeah.
Well, compared to high energy physics measurements, you know, that where we're doing at the percent per mil, the Zen mass, you do not control all the factors very well. You know, when the Earth tides are changing the mass of your boson by parts per per thousand compared to this. Yeah, I'm not an expert here. So you'll probably see a colloquium on such measurements or such traps. But I find it completely amazing. Another completely amazing measurement I find are these gravitational wave interferometers that have unbelievable precision also in terms of the distance, the measurement of the distance. So if you have a gravity wave that's coming in, you know, one leg is shortened, the other is gets a little longer, and they're bouncing off the laser beam many times on these mirrors. And if you look at the delta that they're measuring, it's much smaller than the nucleus. And just the thermal noise off of the mirror is of order, you know, the size of atoms. And so this I find completely amazing. It might be, it might be more precise than this. Yeah. So, have you discussed gravitational waves? I thought I saw. No? Because you have experimental. No? Gravity? No? Okay. Go ahead.
So I see that the theoretical uncertainty is higher than experimental. What is the limitation, and can we do better than that?
I have the paper, so we can look. But I think that the most difficult term is this one. And here they're calculating an enormous amount of Feynman diagrams for QED. But at least it's relatively well known. And this is also the error on the electroweak part is quite small. So I think it's coming mostly from the hadronic component. Then muons, I don't think I showed the, no, you're right. So this is times 10 to the minus 11. Do you know, Cliff?
First one to comment, is it better?
Yeah, well, why is it, why it's harder if you've got a muon here, theoretically, than an electron? Naively, now that I think about it, I would say it's easier. You know, you have a massive particle.
Yeah, I said something now I got wrong, but we can reconstruct it if we give it like half an hour. Now.
Mm-hmm. Can give it as an exercise.
There you go. Because I know you'll be doing your exercises. And is the reason why the measurement is so precise is because frequencies are really just. Do a really good job of measuring frequencies.
Yeah. I think they have I shouldn't speak. If you want to know a bit more about this, I can prepare 2-3 slides based on the paper that I have on my computer. But I'm not an expert in all the traps. But you have a, you have magnetic, anyway, they have resonant cavities, and so they can measure very, very precisely the frequencies. But I wanted to, even though I'm not an expert, I wanted to mention these two because one is unbelievably impressive and agrees, and the other is also quite impressive in terms of precision, but doesn't. It could be that the problem in the past they found problems in the calculations.
So how do we read that plot?
So the blue is the measurement, and these are different calculations, theory calculations. Oh. And so the zero is defined as the truth. The experimental measurement and calculation.
Except you showed us this earlier plot of the PDD of how the experimental measurement is drift over time.
Ah, yeah.
Can't reuse that as truth.
Yeah. Well, in this case, I mean, it's a different example, right? Yeah. Because you have a prediction, you're supposed to land here, and then this is what you measure. You might be tempted to say, we did something wrong, but.
Do they blind those experiments the way you're describing?
I don't know. I hope they do.
Well, so if there's no more questions, then we're good until tomorrow. So
okay.
See you tomorrow.
Okay, see you tomorrow.